White Rocket Entertainment.
What business does an elf, a man, and a dwarf have in the Riddermark? Speak quickly!
We track a band of Uruk-hai westward across the plain. They've taken two of our friends captive.
Look for your friends, but do not trust to hope. It has forsaken these lands.
We're lost. I don't think Gandalf meant for us to come this way.
He didn't mean for a lot of things to happen, Sam.
It cannot be.
I come back to you now, at the turn of the tide.
White Rocket Entertainment, podcast number 261.
You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
10, 9, 8, 7, ignition sequence started. All engines are started. We have ignition, 2, 1, 0, we have a liftoff. We have a liftoff and it's lighting up the area. It's just like daylight here at Kennedy Space Center as the Saturn V is moving off the pad. It is now clear of the tower.
Welcome to the White Rocket Podcast, brought to you by White Rocket Entertainment, in association with the Earth Station One Network. It's one long conversation with a variety of guests about the best of popular culture. I'm Van Allen Plexico, and in this episode, John Ringer returns, our semi-regular co-host, because it's time to journey back to Middle Earth for part two of our in-depth coverage and discussion of J.R.R. Tolkien's Lord of the Rings trilogy with the Two Towers. John, welcome back aboard.
Thanks, Van. Excited to be here again.
Yeah, we had a lot of fun doing about an hour and a half show, more or less, a couple of weeks ago on The Fellowship of the Ring, which is my personal favorite of the three. But I'm very excited to talk about the Two Towers because I love Fellowship so much that there's not a lot I can criticize about it. I just love it. Whereas the Two Towers, I have a number of... I like it. I don't dislike it by any means. It's the middle part of the story, obviously. But there's more things I want to get into, right? And kind of see what you think. And am I wrong? Am I right? You know, do we see it the same way? So I've been looking forward to this one, especially due to that fact, to the fact that... you know, there's always more to talk about when you have an issue with something than when you just love it, you know.
Sure.
So, before we, you know, get into the full introduction here and started, what are your overall thoughts about the Two Towers in terms of as a book? I mean, I don't want to go in depth yet, but just on the surface, you know, what do you think of when you think about the Two Towers?
When I think about the Two Towers book or movie, I immediately think about Helm's Deep.
Right.
I mean, because to me, that's the pivotal scene in the whole thing. Mm. You know, we can get into the differences between the book and the movie, but the biggest one at the outset is that in the book, the two stories are completely different. Like, they're completely separated.
Yeah.
One half of the book is about, you know, Rohan and Merry and mm-hmm. Pippin and Aragorn. And the other half of the book is about Frodo and Sam and Mordor. And they don't go back and forth like the movie does. They're completely right. separate.
Right.
And I think that structure works well for the book because it really makes you feel like those events are not, you know, connected and that the time is kind of, there, things are happening, but you're not sure what the synchronicity of the time is. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's a neat thing because, you know, it's funny. People talk about The Lord of the Rings like it's three books. And it's funny because three books is really like the third thing it is. It's really one big book that got split into three parts because of publishing restrictions back then. But the second thing it is six books. It's really six books in one. It just got divided up into three by pairing off one and two, three and four, five and six. And so, like you say, he kind of stuck to one thing per each of those six books. And so book three is Rohan. It's Aragorn and Gimli and Legolas running around Rohan chasing Merry and Pippin and the orcs. And book four is all Frodo, Sam, and Gollum.
Yep.
And you don't think about that because the movie, I remember when they were making it, Peter Jackson saying, well, one thing we're definitely changing is we're going to mix them together, because in a contemporary movie, you just can't do that, right? You couldn't have an hour and a half of one thing and then an hour and a half of the other. The audience would lose their mind. So cross-cutting is much more of a contemporary way of doing it. I understand that. Okay, so let's hold off on that, and we'll discuss if that's good or bad, if it works or doesn't work for us and all that when we get to that point. Before we get going, as always, this is another one of the special episodes that is primarily going out to our White Rocket patrons from Patreon. It'll be released to the public a bit later on. We're recording this on March 23rd. We recorded back, I guess, the end of January, early February, maybe. We recorded the Fellowship of the Ring, and it's still only for our members, but it'll be coming out to the general public just in a few days. So if you're hearing this sometime in late March, we appreciate you because you're one of our patrons. You're helping White Rocket stay on the air. You're helping with not only this show, the White Rocket podcast, but our other shows like the James Bond show and also even the AU Wishbone. So we really appreciate it. And I have to, of course, by name mention our great patrons who have qualified to be right up there on our banner. And that's, of course, Nicholas Cottrell. Bill Matthews, Dave Medinas, Mark Squire, Michael Kirshner, and Dave Powell. You guys are absolutely tremendously appreciated, and we thank you. For everybody else, if you're hearing this a bit later on and you want to know how could I have heard this like 2 months early, you can get in on exclusive videos and shows like this for as little as $1 a month, all the way up to getting everything we produce, including books, for free as soon as they come out as part of our top tier. And mainly, though, you'll just be showing your support and helping us to continue to produce the best quality entertainment podcasts like this and like the AU Wishbone. Videos, and I've been doing 1 to 2 videos just for our members every week, books, comics, everything else. So if you want to know how to do that, just go to patreon.com/Van Allen Plexico. Patreon.com, that's Patreon, patreon.com/Van Allen Plexico. Okay. Or I mention it occasionally on Twitter and on Facebook, too, if you want to look for it there. We really appreciate it. Okay, let's get on to business. The first thing we need to do, I think, John, is do another round of trivia, because that was a whole lot of fun. I'm looking forward to when the big audience gets to hear our first show and get their reaction to our trivia contest, because I don't like to admit, but you beat me pretty soundly. I think it was 10-8. Last time we did like 12 questions, I think so,
two cards worth each.
Yeah, we did one card at the front, one at the end. So you want to go ahead and bust one out?
Sure.
Ha-ha. All right, here we go. This is the part I've been looking forward to in particular. So I'm going to dig deep down in my little box here. I sent John what it is. For those that didn't listen to the first show yet, what happened is I have the Lord of the Rings movie edition Trivial Pursuit, and I'd never opened it. I bought it and kind of stuck it in the closet and forgot about it. And so when we were getting ready to do these shows, I found the little box of cards with the questions on them, And I thought, well, gosh, I don't know the answers to any of these yet because I haven't ever looked at them. So I just randomly pulled out a chunk of them and mailed them to John. So that way he and I can quiz each other, and it's totally fair because neither one of us had ever seen them before. Okay, so who's going to go first? You want to do all of yours and all of mine, all of yours, or do we go back and forth? I can't remember.
I think I'll ask all of mine, but and then with no answers, and then you think about
it. Oh, right, right.
And then you ask all yours. All right?
Okay. Yeah, that's right.
First question is, who kisses the dying Boromir's brow?
Mm. Okay.
Next question, what is Grima's promised prize if he brings about the fall of Rohan for his master?
Cool. Hey, that's a good one for tonight's show.
It is.
Okay.
Very relevant.
Mm-hmm.
Who does Galadriel give the Light of Arendelle to when the Fellowship leaves Lothlorien?
Okay.
What objects do the Fellowship trackers hide behind as Éomer's men approach on the plains?
Okay.
And then what sensation does Gandalf feel as he returns to life after the Balrog battle?
Ooh, that's an interesting one. I'm going to have to think about that one particularly hard.
That's a tough one.
All right.
And then the last one is, what hobbit does Billy Boyd say has a knack for doing the wrong thing at the wrong time?
Hmm. Interesting. Okay. I'm going to have to think about at least two or three of those. Those are good. Okay. So we'll leave those out there for just a second. Now, I'm going to ask yours. Now, I can't remember how we did this before. Do we come right back and do them again and answer them right after this?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, here we go. That gives our audience a chance to think about them a little bit. Yeah, okay. Okay, here are your six. And again, I just pulled this randomly out of the box. I have no idea if these are good or bad questions. Number one, who keeps Frodo from putting on the ring as the hobbits hide from a ringwraith under a rooted tree? Oh. Who keeps Frodo from putting on the ring as the hobbits hide from a ringwraith under the rooted tree? Okay. Number two, who calls Eowyn, quote, some wild thing, unquote, and compares her bower to a hutch? Number three, tell me if you need me to repeat anything. Number three, what's another name for the seeing stone that Saruman uses to communicate with Sauron? Number four, what creature does Gollum find to eat in the dead marshes? Number five, who does not participate in Theoden's charge down the Helm's Deep causeway, Aragorn, Legolas, or Gimli? And finally, what do the initials JRR? Oh, you got the you got the golden prize question. What do the initials JRR stand for in Tolkien's name? All right. Now, it's my turn to try to answer yours, right?
That's true.
And I'm gonna keep score here like I did last time. So fire away. Tell me number one.
Who kisses the dying Boromir's brow?
No, that's Aragorn. Easy.
That's correct.
All right. Number two.
The next question. What is Grima's promised prize if he brings about the fall of Rohan for his master?
Well, he glances over at Eowyn, so I'm gonna say Eowyn.
That is correct.
All right.
Who does Galadriel give the Light of Elendil to when the Fellowship leaves Lothlorien?
Our most beloved star, to Frodo.
That is correct.
May it be a light for you in dark places when all other lights fail.
Very good. What objects do the Fellowship trackers hide behind as Éomer's men approach on the plains?
I want to say some kind of boulders or big rocks.
That's it.
Okay. I wasn't sure. I'm like, that seemed kind of obvious, but okay. I'm 4-for-4. Now it gets a little harder.
What sensation does Gandalf feel as he returns to life after the Balrog battle?
Okay, I'm Gandalf. I'm lying here dead. He gasps. The stars wheeled overhead. It looks like that the end of 2001: A Space Odyssey. He ends up in a hotel room with a space pod sitting there. He says it feels like a whole lot of time passed, right? Like every moment was an age long period of the Earth or something like that. I felt. I mean, I remember everything about that scene except what sensation he feels. It says life came back. I was returned to finish
the
mission.
You are quoting the scene.
Yes, I was returned to finish the mission. I beat my enemy and smote his ruin on the mountainside. And then the stars wheeled about and every breath was an age of the Earth. And then I came back to life and... There's something in there about his sensation, but I can't remember it. I'm going to kick myself when you tell me. Go ahead and tell me. I give up.
Cold.
Cold.
Remember, he wakes up naked in the snow, basically.
Yeah, I'm sure that would be. All right. So I forfeit that one. All right, last one. Right.
What hobbit does Billy Boyd say has a knack for doing the wrong thing at the wrong time?
Well, see, this was a confusing question because Billy Boyd is Pippin. But if he was talking about a different hobbit, you would have said, what hobbit does Pippin say has a knack for doing the wrong thing at the wrong time? So since you say Billy Boyd, I'm going to say he's talking about himself, so I'm going to say Pippin.
You're correct.
I used logic and reason on that one. You like that?
Very nice.
All right, here you go. I've left the door open for you to take the lead if you can do a sweep. So here we go. I have not looked at the answers yet, but I do know the answers to some of these. Number one, who keeps Frodo from putting on the ring as the hobbits hide from a ringwraith? I guess the one that's going under a rooted tree.
I'm going to say Sam.
It is Sam. Yes. I wasn't sure. I was like, it's either Sam or Merry. I knew it wasn't Pippin. Number two, who calls Eowyn some wild thing and compares her bower to a hutch, whatever that means?
Wormtongue?
Yes. Remember when he talks about when he's whispering to her and she says, your words are poison, and she runs off? That's that bit. I couldn't understand half of what he says there, even though I just love, we'll get to it, but I absolutely love that. Brad Dourif is one of my favorite actors ever. I'm a sucker for like the quirky actors that do a lot of sci-fi stuff. So David Warner, Brad Dourif, you know, those guys, I just really, really, Christopher Lee, you know, I really have always liked them. And I was really happy when Brad Dourif wasn't supposed to originally have that part. They had another actor cast and something happened and he couldn't do it. And they called up Brad Dourif and got him down to New Zealand like a day to get him to do it. I thought he did a great job.
He was really good.
You know that he was also the evil Mentat in Dune, right?
Which version?
The first one, Piter. In the Alan Smithy, you know, the what's his name? The Sting movie.
Oh, good gosh. I blacked that out. Remember, we've talked about that.
Well, he was the Mentat that had like the, you know, they had the big bushy eyebrows and everything. Yeah, I love him. He was also the doctor on Deadwood, and he was fantastic in that role. Number three, what's another name for the seeing stone that Saruman uses to communicate with Sauron?
Palantir.
It is the Palantir. They're not all accounted for. Let's see. Number four, what creature does Gollum find to eat in the dead marshes? I wouldn't have gotten this. I would not have gotten this.
I mean, there's one point in the movies where he eats a fish, and there's one point in the movies where he catches rabbits and they cook them, but that's not in the marshes.
There's only one way to eat a brace of conies.
Yeah.
What's taters, precious? Taters? What's taters?
Crisis. Is it some kind of something in a shell, like a mollusk or something?
Is that your answer?
It is.
Nope, it's a worm.
Oh, that's right. He likes it wriggling. Yeah, no.
I'd forgotten that one too, yeah. Let's see. Number five. You can still tie me this round, which you probably will do. Number five. Who does not... I like this question. This is good. I'd never thought about it. Who does not participate in Theoden's charge down the Helm's Deep Causeway? Aragorn, Legolas, or Gimli?
It's Gimli because he's blowing the horn.
Yeah. I totally didn't think about that. But it would have been awkward to have him, you know, on the horse, I guess.
That's right.
Because he falls off and stuff. That's all right. It was deliberate. It was deliberate. And finally, number six... What does J.R.R. stand for in Tolkien's name?
I'm embarrassed that I'm going to get it wrong because I cannot remember. I've read the books 20 times, all of them. I've read the, you know, Silmarillion and Finnish Tales and all that stuff. You know, John Ray Richardson.
I know it, but I'm not really sure how I know it. It's John Ronald Ruel.
That's right. Yeah, I remember the
Ruel. Let me see how you spell Ruel. R-E-U-E-L. Yeah. I don't remember how I know that, but I just happen to know that. Okay, so... all right, let me see. So, yeah, I didn't mark you down for Gimli. No, actually, you got four.
No, I missed two.
You didn't get the worm, and you didn't get... Yeah, okay. So it's 5-4, but we got another round coming up in a little while. So stay tuned, everybody, and we'll do part two, and we'll see. Because last time at this point, John was ahead, and he went on to win. This time I'm ahead, so we'll see if by one, so we'll see what happens. This is fun. I always enjoy this. All right, so let's dig on into the Two Towers. We kind of, you know, you laid us out a nice little outline for what to talk about, and you kind of start out by saying your overall feelings about this movie. Well, we talked about it a little bit. But see, here's kind of my thing on it. I am usually not big on middle chapters because my problem with middle chapters is that they don't really have a beginning or an ending. And they're important material. They're usually darker too, because if the third chapter of something is going to be the big victory, then by definition, the second chapter needs to have some pretty serious losses and stakes, right? The you know, one of the best examples is The Empire Strikes Back. I know that most people probably like it the best, which totally eludes me because I've spent my life arguing that The Empire Strikes Back is my least favorite of the original Star Wars movies. But that's again because it doesn't have a beginning, B, it doesn't have an end, and C, it's darker and more depressing. And The Two Towers is kind of the same way. Plus, I'm going to argue, and I want to hear what you think about this as we get going forward, because you have a note about extended versus regular. I'm going to go ahead and argue that the theatrical version of The Two Towers is almost incomprehensible in places.
I'd give you that.
It, of all three, and I mean all three of them benefited from the extended versions. I think the Fellowship of the Ring, you just got a couple of nice extra bits. Return of the King, you got some really important bits that were not vital for an average movie audience, but for a Tolkien fan were vital. But for The Two Towers, you got like actual missing parts of the story that the story didn't make much sense without.
Mm-hmm.
So when I think about The Two Towers, I think, A, my least favorite of the three. In fact, I only saw it, I think, in the theater like twice. The others, we established last time, I saw Fellowship of the Ring 8 times in the theater. And I know I saw Return of the King at least 4, if not 5. But I may have only seen The Two Towers twice, maybe 3 times in the theater. That's still more than almost any other movie I've ever seen, but it's... at least of the three. So what are your overall feelings about this movie?
I mean, again, I love these movies. And so I love this movie. One of the things you were talking about that doesn't have a beginning and an end. One of the things I appreciate about this movie is like you said, it really is one giant book, but it's also one giant movie. And you have to think of it in terms of like a one big 13-hour movie or whatever.
Yeah.
And the first hour and a half of that 13 hours is like the setup, the introduction, the kickoff.
Yeah.
And so that's the first, you know, half basically of Fellowship.
Mm-hmm.
And the so when you get to the Two Towers, you don't have to do a setup. You could go straight into it. And one of the things I love is that they open with this scene, immediate action scene, and return to the fight with Gandalf and the Balrog. And basically, as soon as the theater gets dark, you're there. And so I kind of love that start. And I was just, I was expecting a little bit of recap or build up or something, and it went straight to that. And so I really like that part.
Definitely. I agree with that. I was amazed that they did that. And I remember some talk about it right when it came out. Of course I saw it opening night in Washington, but I remember them saying, the reviewers saying it just opens right on the action. And I mean, technically what it opens on is a flashback. Or in some ways it's a dream, right? Because it's like Frodo wakes up, having experienced it right after it's over. But we see the battle in Khazad Dûm from Gandalf's perspective instead of from the rest of the Fellowship's perspective this time, and that was really awesome. I love that opening scene where you see him falling, and that must be a really really deep pit, by the way. Because he falls like he jumped out of an airplane, like Jaws pushed him out of the airplane in Moonraker is what that scene's like.
And?
I know, it's a long way down. He gets his sword back, and he fighting the Balrog, and just keeps... The Balrog only gets one good shot at him the whole time. He's just whooping up on that Balrog the whole way down. And then when they get down to the bottom, he just whoops up on him some more, and hits him with that awesome lightning bolt to the sword, lightning charge sword to the chest.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty neat, right? I don't remember that in the book. I don't remember Gandalf creating a lightning sword strike in the book, but it certainly worked in the movie.
No, it was dramatic, and it was a great scene. So.
Well, Tolkien was never very big on like giving you graphic descriptions of magic. You know, it's a very low magic universe, and so when Gandalf does, you know, there's several times that happens. Like for example, you know, in the books, we're just basically told that Saruman takes Gandalf hostage or captive, whereas in the movie we have wizard fight. And in the books, we're told that Gandalf smites his enemy, the Balrog, whereas in the movie, we see wizard versus demonic creature fight. So the movies really do more of trying to lay it all out for us. Tolkien just was not interested in doing a play-by-play, you know?
Mm-mm. It wasn't his style. It wasn't his thing.
He was never going to say Gandalf raised his sword high, the Balrog slashed his whip down. There's an experience. It just that was not what he was going to do, right? So, So that opening bit is cool. Then we end up we see that the hobbits are in, I guess, the Imenmul trying to get into Mordor, and that's where they're going to encounter Gollum and everything. And I want to talk about that. We get Gollum, and there was no Gollum in the first movie except for that little tiny bit where he's sort of like crawling and you see his eyes peeking through the cracks or whatever. We just saw a tiny little glint, and I guess...
He floats by in the river one time.
Yeah, you see very, very little. I know, I love that scene too because he's floating by hanging onto a log, and they're like, oh, he's... Aragorn's like, he's too good of a waterman to for us to lose. And right about that time, the log goes thunk into a rock or something. And I'm serious. The first time that happened, I was half expecting for Gollum to like come up out of the water and little birds to be flying around his head. Tweet, 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 tweet. So What do you think about Gollum? Did they pull him off? I mean, you know, did they really hit a home run with him in this movie, or what? Were you disappointed with him, or what do you think about him?
It's one of the things I really worried about, because he's very obviously very important, and he's a very complex character and tough to pull off. And I really think they did.
Yeah.
I think they pulled it off. I think the multiple personality thing, him talking to himself, reflections in the pool and that kind of thing, or just out in the air talking to himself, I thought was really good. And I thought the, you know, kind of Frodo bringing him around to the good side of him and him kind of banishing the bad side and then it coming back because of the bad things happening, I thought they handled it pretty well.
Yeah, I liked, like, they used different facial expressions so you could tell who was talking, which version of him was talking, right? Like, when he's Smeagol, he's like smiling or ingratiating or pleading in his expression and his tone. And when he's Gollum, he's like all devious looking and evil looking and he's harsh, you know. And you get that great exchange where he says, "Leave now and never come back." And he keeps saying it, and finally Gollum disappears, and he's, "Smeagol is free!" You know, that was really cool. I guess I would say Gollum is to the Two Towers really what Yoda was to The Empire Strikes Back. You know, he's a really difficult-to-pull-off special effect that is a really important character smack dab in the second movie. And I can't imagine in 2002 them doing a better job with him.
No, I mean, again, from the graphics, the voice, his relationship with Frodo and Sam, I thought it was really good.
I'm trying to remember the name of... Oh, yeah, Andy Serkis. Andy Serkis has really made a reputation as being able to do the motion capture acting and voice. You know, he's gone on to do other things since then. He was King Kong in Peter Jackson's King Kong, and he was Claw in Avengers Age of Ultron, among other things. But and I love that we actually get to see him as Andy Serkis in Return of the King when he plays the original Smeagol, but we'll get to that obviously in the next show. Gollum, yeah, such a central part and pretty well realized. I mean, I think it holds up. Mira and I have been watching The Two Towers on my Blu-ray extended set this last week, and I hadn't looked at him in a while, and when he came on the screen, I'm like, man, that's pretty impressive. I mean, you know, today you look at it and you think maybe it could be a little bit better, but for 2002, that's 15 years ago. I mean, it holds up. It holds up pretty well. So, what did you think about the movie going in? I mean, you know, I can't remember. Were you following its production all along like I was? I was on the OneRing.net like every day from 1998, 99, 2000, all the way until the movie started coming out, just reading every set report and, you know, spy story that they had, you know.
Sure. I was paying attention.
Yeah. So what were you thinking before it came out?
I mean, again, the success of the first movie and how great it was gave you enormous confidence that they could pull the whole thing off, all three movies. So, yep. I mean, at that point, I was just excited because I knew the first one was so good that they could do it, that they could make the battles really good. And I was excited to see what they could do with the bigger set-piece battle at Helm's Deep. That was the kind of thing I was really kind of looking forward to. But also the other things we'll touch on, the Ents and the the Riders of Rohan. I was interested to see what they could do with all that.
Yeah, I've never been a big Ent fan, and I was kind of looking toward that with dread. And it wasn't bad; it was just about what I expected it to be. we went up to we were in Washington D.C. to see it, and I remember going into the theater and I had tickets to like the 7 o'clock show or something. So of course we got there about 4 to get in line, and there was no line for it yet, which surprised me because when I went to see Return of the King, I got in line at like 10 o'clock at night. No. 2 o'clock in the morning for the show the theater opened at 11 in the morning, and I was 30 something in line. But, So we actually got to start the line. I made a handwritten sign and said the line for Two Towers, 7 o'clock starts here. And people started lining up behind us. So that was pretty neat. It was like 5 o'clock. Very excited. But I remember that, we can go ahead and transition and talk about the extended versus regular version too while we're talking about this. I remember thinking in the theater, I knew after the first one, it seemed a little odd that the running time of the first one was 2 hours and 59 minutes. That just seemed a little on the nose, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And you come to find out that New Line had told him it cannot be 3 hours long. So Peter Jackson's, okay, we got to get down to 2:59. And he did. So the Two Towers had to be cut down to 2:59. And here's the funny thing about it. You would think the Two Towers would be shorter, because they cut the beginning off of the Two Towers and put it into Fellowship of the Ring, and they cut the ending off the Two Towers and put it in Return of the King. So the Two Towers movie has two major set pieces missing from it, beginning and end. And mm-hmm. yet it still, when they cut it down to 2:59, it really, to me, and you tell me what you think about this, when they cut the Two Towers down to 2:59, it really felt to me like critically important material was missing.
Which specific critically important material?
Okay, two things in particular. One, the end of the Battle of Helm's Deep. It's like they've been fighting. They do this charge. Éomer shows up. Yay, we win, the end. And I'm like,
It was a little too sudden.
It was very sudden and abrupt. And we didn't even get the woods that come and eat all the orcs, you know, when they run into it. So thank goodness for the extended version. That was a crime, by the way. That's one of the coolest scenes in the Two Towers, and it wasn't there. It's in the extended version. And then the other part that was missing is, and I'm not sure even the extended version really addresses this. I'm going to talk about it a bit more later. But the whole bit in Osgiliath is not really clear what's going on. It's like Faramir is being a jerk. A Nazgul flies up, and Faramir's like, you guys can go on your way. And I'm like, what? Why does he just let them go? He spends the whole half of the movie telling them how they are critically, you know, important. He can't let them go. This, that, and the other. He's got Gollum captured and all that. And then when that Nazgul comes up and then flies away, Faramir's like, okay, you can go. And I mean, even the extended version doesn't really explain it, but my gosh, the theatrical version, it is just so abrupt and so it doesn't make any sense. So what do you know about that? What does that, do you know?
To me, the Faramir thing is like, he's channeling his father and taking the prisoner. That's not, what he would do, but he's hearing his father's words about the importance of the ring, and the importance of, learning about details about Boromir's death. And so he starts to take them back to Gondor, and then they get to Osgiliath. And the whole Osgiliath thing was a movie add-in that's not in the books at all. But then he sees that the Nazgul, want the ring and want Frodo, that's all that matters. Like they that was much more important to them than taking the city or whatever at that point. And I think he realizes then that it's a much bigger deal, but I think he also, it kind of shakes him out of this doing what his dad wants to do to coming back to who he is as a person. And he says, we're not doing that anymore. So,
But I mean, that's a logical explanation, but I just don't know where the movie really says that is the only thing. I mean, the movie just, I don't know. What else do you think about you comparing the extended and the versus the theatrical cut? I mean, those are the two things to me that I really had a problem with. Is there anything else that
Doesn't the extended version do a better job explaining some of the worm tongue machinations and stuff? Isn't that a little skimmed down in the theatrical version?
Probably, because I've only seen the theatrical version like twice.
I think some of that stuff some of his, the way that he's doing stuff and the things that are happening is cut out a little bit.
Yeah.
And if, you know, like the attack on the village in Rohan, I think is either cut out or much shorter. So I mean, those things are,
that's not a huge deal maker either way, but.
Well, they really do in the theatrical version of all three movies, they do kind of cut Saruman short, and particularly in the third, obviously, which we'll get to. And so I was happy that one of the things the extended versions do is give us a lot, you know, give us a good bit more Christopher Lee, and we kind of see Saruman's character arc a bit more. He's not just a prop like he is in the theatrical. The theatrical versions just irked the crap out of me. I understand why they exist. I understand why they're that way. But now that these things don't have to be in the theater anymore, trying to make as much money as they can in as few hours every night as possible, I just would just assume they just never have that we never hear from the movie version again. You know what they're trying to do is they're trying to make as much money as they can in a day by showing it as many times as possible. If a movie was 30 minutes long, they could, you know, make a bajillion dollars off of it. But when a movie is 3.5 hours long, you can only show it a couple of times per screen in the afternoon and evening. So I understand it. You know, when they got to the Return of the King, they said, go ahead and take 3.5 hours. We know you've got a lot to get in here. And so I think PJ went to New Line and said, look, to make this movie right, we need 3.5 hours. And they said, all right, you know, you've shown you can generate money. So, by the way, we didn't really talk about this. The first movie was nominated for several Oscars, and it won, I think, 2 or 3 technical awards. It was nominated for Best Supporting Actor for Ian McKellen as Gandalf, and I was so depressed and crushed when he didn't win because I knew that's the best Gandalf really you're going to get. He's more like a general almost in the other movies, but in the first one
yes.
is when he's the old wizard. And so I'm like, well, if he didn't win it for this one, he's not going to win it for the later ones. And I don't think they even got another acting nomination for the whole rest of the trilogy, did they? I don't think so.
No, I don't think so.
But of course, the Two Towers barely even got any nominations. Return of the King got 13 and won all 13, which I think was a record. So we'll talk about that coming up next time. Favorite scenes from the Two Towers. We already talked about one, the opening Gandalf versus the Balrog. That's pretty hard to top. What else do you love in the Two Towers?
I love the Ents attacking Isengard.
Yeah.
Yeah, the march of the Ents down the hill and them tearing the walls apart and the fortress apart with their hands and the you know, breaking the dam and all that stuff. Mm. I love some of the fight scene parts of Helm's Deep. I love when Aragorn and Gimli, they need to fix the gate. So Aragorn and Gimli jump out on the ramp. And Gimli's like, throw me out there.
Yeah, toss me.
And I love the contest. I mean, it's in the book too, but I love the contest between Gimli and Legolas for who kills the most orcs. That's one of my favorite parts of it.
Hey, that was what's so funny about that is there were so many people that had never read the books, and they were like, you know, oh, this is okay, but they're like, I guarantee you, I know one thing that wasn't in the books, and that's the contest over who killed the most orcs. That had to be a movie thing, and people like me are like, and you are like, nope, that's in the books. Because it just seemed like something that he would have added, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But it's actually in the books. Not the part about that one's still moving. That's because my axe is buried in his brain pan or something like that. That's a good line. I do like when Gimli keeps getting covered up with dead creatures and he's just like getting scrushed, you know. That's pretty mm-hmm. funny. I think that probably other than the Gandalf fight at the beginning, I love the stuff in Rohan. I really like the stuff in Rohan. I love the actor that plays Theoden. He's in a lot of the stuff. He was the captain of the Titanic. He was a British soldier in Gandhi. And I really like him a lot. And I like all the stuff where you have the three hunters, even though the Gimli trying to keep up stuff is kind of tiresome really quick. One scene in it in the Two Towers that I didn't like as much, I thought that they misinterpreted, was the Dead Marshes. Because they, in the movie, they have like little fires burning, like it's a natural gas field or something.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in the book, my impression that it was supposed to be like little candles burning underwater to look all creepy and stuff. I didn't think they were like open
ghost light kind of thing.
Yeah, not open flame like they're running through an Exxon refinery, but you know, like little lights down under the water that makes it all creepy and spooky and haunted. That's, you know, and then we get the whole dramatic thing of Frodo falling in and all that. So, I just wasn't thrilled with that, but otherwise it's pretty cool. What did you think about the decision to cut the whole Boromir gets killed thing out and put it at the end of Fellowship of the Ring, and to cut all of Shelob out and put it at the beginning of Return of the King?
I mean, I get it, because the Shelob thing, there's a lot there and it takes a while.
Yeah.
I mean, the book leaves you with the, you know, you kind of, I can't remember. Do you think Frodo's dead?
Yeah, he gets stung by Shelob and wrapped up in a web.
And like Sam takes the ring and yes. goes on.
Yes.
And that's the end of the book. And so it really does leave you with the Frodo's dead, Sam's got to finish it kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so they put that into the next movie, but I think they had to, because that would have taken another half hour. I mean, that was a lot there.
It's true.
So I think that's just a timing thing. And the, you know, the Boromir stuff, it's not in the Fellowship of the Ring?
No. At the end of Fellowship of the Ring, he's blowing the horn or whatever. And then at the beginning of the Two Towers, the first chapter is called The Passing of Boromir, I believe.
Okay. So that just made narrative sense. You weren't going to leave them in the middle of a fight in the movie with like what happens or whatever. So and I liked it with, you know, it made sense from the splitting it up with Frodo and Sam go one way, Merry and Pippin are taken, and then everybody else chases them and Boromir's dead. I mean, that Aragorn's big speech in the first movie.
Right.
Was going to put a bow on it. So
yeah. You know, and the thing about Shelob being in this movie, I think that what Peter Jackson said was, and you're right about the, it would make the Two Towers way too long, but the converse side of it is that Peter Jackson said, look, in the Frodo and Sam and Gollum part of Return of the King, you know, Tolkien spends chapter after chapter of them just crossing the desert and the rocks and everything. And he's like, yeah. I'm not putting that in the movie. So he says, you know, once they get past Shelob, it's like bang, 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 they're at the volcano.
Mm-hmm.
So he just didn't feel the need to drag out them crossing Mordor once they get past Shelob. And I think that was probably a smart thing to do. Okay, a few things I wanted to run by you. And then we'll pause for a quick break. Let me see where we are. Okay. First up, Saruman. I'm confused about movie Saruman compared to him, not just compared to book Saruman, but compared to himself in other parts of each of the movies. Because there are times... All right, let me back up. In the books, we get the sense that Saruman is maybe pretending to follow Sauron, but he really wants everything for himself. And so he's kind of playing along with Sauron, but he really wants to betray him with his Uruk-hai and everything, and him take the ring. In the movies, it's more like Saruman is totally a servant of Sauron and has totally gone over to his side and is following his orders. Do you get an inconsistent sense from Saruman, or is it just me?
No, I think you're right. I think the book Saruman was more independent and had more freedom of operation, and the movie version is more of a, you know, he looked into the Seeing Stone and his mind was kind of taken.
Yeah. I kind of, yeah. Well, somebody I was heard talking the other day made a good point, said that without Saruman, it's like one book. You know, it's done in like 300 pages because Saruman is who messes them up and slows them down half the story.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Sauron sends the Black Riders, but after that, he doesn't really do anything else except attack Minas Tirith.
Well, the thing you lose, we'll talk about the next movie, is the end chapter with Saruman.
Yeah, yeah.
And the kind of the finish of his story. So,
How low he fell by that point, man.
Yes.
That's right. Okay, so I was just curious about that because it bothered me from the very first time I saw Fellowship all the way till now. I don't fully understand Saruman's motivations or his actions. I know that, and again, in different spots in the movie, I do understand him. What I don't understand is the contradictory parts, right? In other words, if he's sitting there saying we must join with Sauron because he's going to kill us all otherwise, yeah, I get that. You know, but then later he's creating the Uruk-hai and he's going to, like, you know, go out and get the ring. Okay, I get that. But is he getting it for Sauron? Is he getting it for himself? Is he going to try to overthrow Sauron with it? I mean, I don't know. Merry and Pippin, I thought this was interesting. They're always a duo, right? You always get Merry and Pippin together. And it's interesting to me how Merry starts to grow. Neither one of them had grown up a bit when they left the Shire. They were both kids, basically. Merry starts to grow up. Pippin is still totally a kid. Merry starts to realize, right? You see this playing out across the movies. Merry starts to realize that Pippin is not growing up as fast as he is, and it bothers Merry. And so eventually Merry says, like, you smoke too much, you drink too much, you're not taking things seriously enough, you know, and Pippin's all hurt. But Merry's right. But the problem is that they used to be the same, and now Merry is getting more mature, and he's kind of leaving Pippin behind. And here's what's interesting, John. They have to separate for them both to finish growing up, right? Once they're separate from each other, and Pippin is all alone, now Pippin has no choice but to start the same process that Merry is already going through. Do you agree with that assessment?
Yes. I hadn't thought about it that way, but I agree. It makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. I think it's really neat. They're neat characters and really cool actors. Let me see. Theoden. Were you expecting Theoden? We knew that Theoden was mentally controlled by Saruman and then by Wormtongue's suggestions. Were you expecting him to physically be transformed like that?
No, I think that scene that where Gandalf breaks him out of the spell is a great scene.
Yeah.
It was well done. The whole, you know, from the, you know, Wormtongue and his henchmen kind of fist fighting with Aragorn and then while Gandalf is pulling Saruman out.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that it, you know, it made it more than a kind of virtual mind control thing. It made him, mm-hmm. you know, there was clearly this spell in him to make him old and decrepit.
Mm-hmm.
And it was working and it was, you know, ruining the whole country. You could, the scene, you know, the visual of the flag coming off the flagpole and kind of flying
mm-hmm.
and nobody cares or whatever, that was well done.
Yeah. So. You know, I'm glad you said that. There's so many little touches and little tricks that Jackson does all the way through these movies. And I remember him saying at one point, he said about halfway through Return of the King, he said, every night I'm going home and like watching every classic film because he's just trying to find one more trick. When you're filming basically a 12-hour saga or 11-hour saga, you start running out of tricks after a while, you know, like, for example, the flag, or for example, seeing all the gears moving in that door before the, you know, the gates of Minas Tirith in Return of the King, mm-hmm. or seeing the sun behind that bell when the Rohan guy is hitting it with the hammer, you know, and the sun shines through and he hits it and the sun shines through and he hits it, you know, all these little visual tricks that Jackson used. He's like, I'm running out. My bag of tricks is getting empty. So I just thought it was neat that he all the way till the end. And you know, by the way, we haven't really talked about that, but. Or maybe we did. I can't remember now. Did we talk about how Peter Jackson was such a great choice because he was a horror director?
I think we did a little bit.
Because like a Chris Columbus or whoever would have done it straight, whereas Peter Jackson puts all that macabre horror stuff in it. The orcs are so horrible looking and scary. I was quite shocked when I sat down to see Fellowship, and that opening bit shows the orcs, and they are just monstrous. Because, you know, in the cartoons and stuff, they're just kind of like little frog guys or something. And I guess I was expecting live-action versions of that. And instead, we get just these slavering little demon creatures. And I'm going, oh my gosh, the orcs are horrific. They're horrifying.
No, and I mean, only Peter Jackson could do like Shelob justice and the Balrog justice in those kind of scenes.
Yes, so. Yeah. Yeah, it's just amazing. A couple other things. We talked a little bit about Helm's Deep. The ending is just much better in the extended cut because you get a little more explanation of what's happening. I mean, we knew because we'd read the books a bunch, but, you know, it's just not really clear when they are, oh, we're about to die, let's just get on our horses and ride out there and fight. And then all of a sudden, I guess Éomer's crowd shows up with Gandalf when the sun's coming up. But it just kind of cuts off there, and it's not entirely clear. Whereas you get the end of the battle in the extended version, and you get the forest comes, and the orcs run into the forest and disappear, and the trees are like, burp. You know? I love that. I love that the trees get their revenge on the orcs for cutting them down by eating them. That's so cool. And then let's see. We talked about Osgiliath already. Okay. So are there any scenes like that that you wanted to mention as far as like they did a really good job or it's not clear or anything like that?
Well, I want to talk a little bit about book versus movie stuff.
Right. All right. We'll do that in just a second. Let's take a quick break here for a word from White Rocket Entertainment, and we'll be right back to go book versus movie, Lord of the Rings, The Two Towers.
The Avengers Assemble podcast from White Rocket Entertainment. Creator and fan interviews and discussion about Marvel's Avengers comics, movies, and everything else. From Van Allen Plexico and the Jarvis Heads of AvengersAssemble.net, creators of the best-selling Assembled books and the most fanatical Avengers fans on the face of the earth.
Okay, and so we want to talk about the book versus the movie a little bit more. We've talked about already that they lopped off both ends of the book. What else comes to your mind about that?
In terms of the books versus the movies?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, well, the first most important thing is in the movies, it's two different towers.
All right, hold on. Don't say it. This is like another trivia question. All right, let me see if I can do this. Okay. In the book, one of the towers is Cirith Ungol, right?
No.
Oh, I think it is. Hold on now. I'm throwing the flag. I'm pretty sure that in the book, one of the towers is...
They're not both different. Only one tower is different.
I think in the book, it's Isengard and Cirith Ungol. And in the movie, it's Isengard, I mean, Orthanc, and Barad-dûr.
In the movie, it's Isengard and Barad-dûr, Sauron's tower in Mordor. But in the book, it's Isengard and Minas Morgul.
It's not the Tower of Cirith Ungol where they go through the tunnel and everything?
No.
Actually, you know what? It's not Cirith Ungol and Minas Morgul?
No, it's Isengard in Minas Morgul.
So we know that one of them is Orthanc.
Yes.
And the other one, we're not sure about.
Because it's the two, again, in the book, it's two separate stories, and okay. They both go to a tower.
I am going to make the argument to you that there is at least one interpretation. I think it's not a settled issue. I think that Tolkien said different things at different times. In fact, let's do this. This is a big enough question that I want to know. what are the two towers in the two towers? Because I honestly think that one of them is Cirith Ungol. All right, loosely, any pair from a set of five towers could plausibly fit the title, says Tolkien Gateway. Cirith Ungol, Orthanc, Minas Tirith, Barad-dûr, and Minas Morgul. A trailer for the movie interprets the title as referring to the alliance between Orthanc and Barad-dûr. Ha! So it's five. That was an even more complicated question than you realized, didn't it?
But they don't even go to Minas Tirith in the second movie.
I agree. Or in the second book.
That's a bunch of.
But see, they end up in the Tower of Cirith Ungol after Shelob. That's where the second book ends.
No, I know.
So that's why I was pretty sure that at least some interpretations say that it's that one. Okay, and you get that great scene in... Is it in...
No.
That's in Return of the King, isn't it?
Yes.
The Cirith Ungol scene. Okay, we'll hold off on that. All right. What else?
One of the other big differences is the Ents and the Entmoot.
Yeah.
And the actions of the Ents and why they attack. I mean, in the books, they make the conscious decision that Saruman is a threat to the trees and he must be... into the way of life events, and therefore they have to take action. In the books, I mean, in the movie, I don't like it nearly as much because it's like the hobbits trick them into like, oh, let's go that way.
Yeah.
And then he sees the devastation, and he's like, oh, now we got to attack. And so it makes Treebeard look like an idiot.
Yeah, like he didn't know that. Like he didn't know that was happening.
Right. So that... I don't like that. It took away the Ents, decision. And then there was some more stuff in the Entmoot, but you can't. That doesn't translate well in the movie. I get that. And then I think, we talked about Faramir, how his character is different. And the whole Asgillia thing is just a complete add-in. There's stuff in the book at all. And then the other big action scene that's in the movie that's not in the book is the battle with the warg riders on the plains in Rohan when they're on horseback and they have the big kind of running fight with the warg riders, and then Aragorn falls off a cliff and everybody thinks he's dead, and there's this drama about how he's not going to make it to Helm's Deep, and Eowyn's all worried about him and stuff. So that's the other big kind of thing that's added in the movie that's not in the book, that the whole Aragorn thing falling off, I don't know about that part, but
the whole Eowyn Aragorn thing in the book, it's barely hinted at really that she likes him, whereas in the movie it becomes this whole romantic triangle subplot. Will he go with Eowyn or will he stick with Arwen? Will he go with Miss Wright or Miss Wright now, basically? and I love that. I mean, they do the whole bit with Eowyn's cooking. I mean, there's no way I've forgotten, and that's in the book, is it?
No, I don't think so.
It fits what they're trying to do, which is saying that she's into fighting and military stuff and being a ruler, and she's not really a good cook. So she gets this idea she'll try to cook. And I do love Viggo Mortensen's performance there, where he's trying to pretend like it's good, And every time she looks away, he tries to like dump it out, and she looks back, and he has to stop and start eating it again. I mean, there's a lot of comedy that Jackson puts in these movies, and I'm really 50-50 on it. Part of me is like, it's cute, it's entertaining, it lightens things up a little bit, but the other part of me is like, no. No, no. It's just
but you can't have 13 hours of serious.
I know, it's true.
You just can't.
Well, but there's times, if the number one thing that annoys me in all these movies is how they just fawn over Frodo either being hurt or looking longingly into the distance or something, I mean, I just, after like the 18th time, I just want to throw something at Frodo. That's my number one. We talked about that in the last one, when they stab him and he's like, I am slain. And he's like, oh, I'm fine. that's my number one peeve. My number two peeve is Gimli the goofy Jerry Lewis. I love Gimli. I don't need him running around, you know, falling off horses and talking about, you know, I'm great sprinters in a short distance, you know, and all that. I mean, you know, come on. Not the beard, you know. They turn Gimli really into a comedy character, and it kind of grates on me after a while. But it's all right. It's all right. I do like the book is two different towers. That's pretty funny. So what else did the movie leave out that we haven't talked about? I'm trying to think the movie left out.
There's no elves at Helm's Deep in the book.
Right.
I mean, that kind of changes things.
Yeah. I think so. That's a good point. That's something I did want to mention. I haven't gotten to that when I'm rewatching it now, so I'd forgotten. But they have the elf who's basically the stand-in for Glorfindel, the guy that met them and took them, you know, into Lothlorien. I can't think of his name now. I like that actor a lot. And Haldir. And I like the idea that he represents these immortal elves being willing to lay down their immortal lives to defend Aragorn and Rohan, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, these other soldiers are dying and they're losing a few years off their life. When those elves are dying, they're losing their immortal lives. They're not going to get to go into the West and live forever, you know, in California or wherever the elves go. So that, I mean, there's a moment there where as they're dying, Haldir looks down and sees the others lying there on the ground dead right before he gets killed or as he's getting killed. And it just struck me so hard. I'm like, look at the sacrifice that they're making. This is really amazing.
Mm-hmm.
That just struck me very hard.
And it sets up, you know, the movies needed a way to set up this kind of alliance of, you know, the races against Sauron. And because it wasn't, without this, it really wasn't happening. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And so I think they had to show that everybody was willing to work together, and this is how they came up with it.
Yeah, no, I agree.
And it was also, you had the kind of Theoden, you know, suicidal and dismaying, we're all going to die kind of, and then the elves, you know, show up and kind of restore his faith.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that kind of plays into the, you know, later his decision to go to Gondor because people came to his aid when he needed it.
Yeah, I agree. I'll tell you one thing I've never fully grasped in my mind, and I've read the books a million times and listened to the unabridged audio a million times, and I've watched the movies a million times. I still cannot fully grasp the layout of Helm's Deep. It's just kind of complicated for this little fort set into the side of the mountain. There's like a wall with a water thing running through it.
Set into the side of a mountain, and there's an outer wall and an inner wall. And there's a gatehouse on both of them. And
there's a dike, whatever that's supposed to be.
It's like, there's a dam kind of thing with a creek that goes through there.
Yeah, I don't get it. Anyway, did they have a giant bowl of gunpowder in the book?
I don't think it was like that in the book.
Orc running like he's in the Olympics.
No, they that part was invented for them. But it did fit in with kind of I was okay with it because it fit in with kind of Tolkien's whole industrialization versus the natural order.
That's fair.
Theme. So I felt like it went in that direction. So I was okay with that. I don't think that they blew up the wall like that in the book.
Every time I see the orc running with the Olympic torch, I want to hear Chariots of Fire playing in the background. Dun 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 dun. Oh man, it just cracks me up. Yeah, the let's see, Faramir taking Frodo Oski. I don't even understand Faramir at all. The battle with the Warg Riders, you mentioned that, yeah, and his horse. I like that he made friends with Brego.
Yes.
Which sounds like a brand of Italian pasta. And then or sauce. I'm gonna put some Brego on this pasta. And then he's like helps him to survive, right? When he's doesn't he come up and like pick him up or something? Yeah.
Yeah, when Aragorn falls off the cliff and he's barely alive, Brago comes in and kind of comes up next to him and helps to basically drags him back to Helm's Deep.
That was Theodred's horse, wasn't it? The king's son.
Yes.
Because he said something like, he's seen enough of war. Let him go. Mm-hmm. But
he had horse PTSD or whatever.
He did, yeah. By the way, that reminds me of like one of the most egregious things I don't like in Return of the King, but we'll get to that later. Okay, so any other differences or anything we want to cover?
No, I mean that. I think that's the main ones. The Ent stuff really bothered me and how they handled that stuff. But the final, because of the ending change in the third movie, what happens to Saruman? That's in this movie, right?
The final fate of Saruman's in Return of the King.
Okay, so that's right. We'll leave that one.
That's one of the two big scenes they cut out of the theatrical that was just like a crime against humanity. Mm-hmm. The other being the Witch King and Gandalf that we'll get to. Okay, well we'll go and do our conclusions and kind of our last thoughts on the Two Towers in just a minute. But first, we got to do round two of our trivia. Ha ha! Round two of our trivia. Woohoo! John is down 5-4. Pick me a card out here. Oh, one other thing I want to mention is the score. By the way, let me get this out real quick because this is important. I absolutely love Howard Shore's score, and I probably said in the first episode, it's been a while, I can't remember, that the Fellowship of the Ring has by far the best score. The Two Towers has basically one new song in it, which is the Rohan music, which is great, but it's one more. And then Return of the King has basically one or two more, which is the Minas Tirith music, which is great, but still, I mean, you know, what happened was that Peter Jackson, after the Fellowship of the Ring came out, he went to Howard Shore and said, I'd like a piece of music in this one that's catchy. That's something that could be, you know, a hit or something. At least it's catchy. And Howard Shore's like, all right. And so he did the Rohan theme, and Peter Jackson said he wasn't totally thrilled with it, but when he left the studio, he found he was humming it. And he says, well, I guess it must have worked then, because I'm humming it. So I do, you know, that's the, I'll probably have it on here somewhere. That's the da 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 da. And they play it with different kinds of stringed instruments to give it kind of a really acoustic, kind of a rough, you know, feel tone to it, and I think it's really effective. Well,
and they always play it when they're showing like the plains and looking across the plains and stuff. So no, it's good.
Yeah, it's very effective. And then of course the big Minas Tirith song in the third one is very big and sweeping and orchestral, which would befit a big city like Minas Tirith. So Shore really just does an amazing job in all three movies of matching the music to what it goes with. You know, I mean, I don't even remember if I talked about it in Fellowship, but you know the music for the elves and the music for the orcs is the same notes, but down like a flat, so that like the not Rivendell, it's totally different, but the Lothlorien, the Lothlorien music is like da da. Da da bum 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 da 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 da, and the orcs is like da 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 da. See, it's the same four notes, but they're flat, and it gives you more of a it's more of an urgent and disturbing tone. So it's because they're elves, but they're elves that went wrong, you know. Mm-hmm. And so the music is elf music that went wrong. I love that. I love that.
I never realized that.
So I play those soundtracks all the time. Always have. Okay. Let's see. Is it my turn to read first?
Yes.
Okay. Here we go. Number one for more Lord of the Rings trivia. A new card has been procured. Number one. Who used to say to Frodo, quote, "It's a dangerous business going out of your door," unquote. Okay.
All right.
Number two, how many tusks does the creature Sam calls an Oliphant have? Number three, what color garments are worn by the Easterling army Sam and Frodo see at the Black Gate? Oh, that's... okay.
Mm.
Yeah, really. I need a swatch to be able to... number four, what dwarf, according to Gandalf, long ago gave Bilbo a mithril shirt as a gift? Mithril. Number five, what duo's duel in the first movie is shown in greater detail at the start of the second movie? Okay, fine.
Huh. Yeah.
If only we'd talked about that some tonight. And number six, what large battle scene was shot outdoors in a rock quarry at night? Well, that's... I certainly know
if
that
If only
one.
We talked about that one.
Yeah, really. All right. You good on those? So let me hear the other ones.
All right. Here are your questions. What name does Hama address Gandalf before he enters the Golden Hall?
Okay.
All right. Who is the last hobbit to jump on the ferry at the escape of the Ringwraiths?
Okay. Yeah.
What fellowship member... Did we use these the last time?
I don't think so.
What fellowship member besides the hobbits is clean-shaven?
No, we haven't used that one before.
Okay. What object's fate did Isildur want all of his bloodline to be bound to?
Okay.
What three things does Eowyn say the wild men are burning when they attack Rohan's people?
Okay. All right.
And the last one is, what is the name of the director of the Weta Workshop LTD?
Oh, man. This is going to kill me because I know it.
All
right, here we go. Number one. Who used to say to Frodo, "It's a dangerous business going out your door"?
Bilbo.
Yes, Bilbo. Bilbo Baggins. Bravest little hobbit of all. Number two. How many tusks does the creature Sam calls an Oliphant have?
Four.
See, I would have said four, but this says six. Okay. I saw four, honestly.
No, I mean, it says six. It's six.
It says six.
I knew it was more than two.
Yeah, I don't know where they're hiding the other two, though, but okay, whatever. Number three, what color garments... Let me put it this way. If you'd asked me that and I'd said four and you said it was six, I'd be like, uh-uh, we're going to fight. So we'll call that one, put that one in the gray area.
Yeah, I mean, I missed it. It was the answer.
Oh, well, we'll see. What color garments are worn by the Easterling army Sam and Frodo see at the Black Gate?
Red?
Yeah, dark red. That's fine. Whatever. That's good enough for me. Number four. What dwarf, according to Gandalf, long ago gave Bilbo a mithril shirt as a gift?
It was the leader of the dwarves in The Hobbit, who was...
I give you half
Thorin,
credit.
Thorin Oakenshield.
Yes, good job. Way to pull it out.
I almost said Durin, but that's Durin's Bane. It's not that.
Right, that's the one in Moria. Number five, what duo's duel in the first movie is shown in greater detail at the start of the second movie?
Gandalf and the Balrog.
Yes. Sound like a new sitcom from ABC. It's Gandalf and the Balrog. And number six, what large battle scene was shot outdoors in a rock quarry at night?
Helm's Deep.
Helm's Deep. All right. I have you with nine, not counting the Oliphant question, which is under review.
No, I missed the Oliphant question.
All right. Now, my turn. What you got?
All right.
What name does Hama give Gandalf before he enters the Golden Hall?
Oh. Now, Minas Tirith calls him Mithrandir for like Grey mm-hmm. Pilgrim. But they call him like Gandalf Stormcrow. Don't they call him?
That's what Wormtongue calls him.
Oh.
Hama calls him Gandalf Greyheim.
Greyheim, right. Okay, fine, yeah. All right.
All right. Who is the last hobbit to jump on the ferry to escape the pursuit of the Ringwraiths?
Frodo, because everything he does has to be freaking dramatic because he's a drama queen.
So funny.
Okay. Was that number two? That was number two?
That's number two.
Okay.
All right. Number three. What fellowship member besides the hobbits is clean shaven?
Leggy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Number four, what object's fate did Isildur want all of his bloodline to be bound to?
Right, read it again.
What object's fate
did
Isildur want all of his bloodline to be bound to?
The One Ring.
That's correct.
She'll be an heirloom of my kingdom.
What three things does Eowyn say the wild men are burning when they attack Rohan's people?
Dinner.
I remember her saying this, but I couldn't remember.
Well, they're burning. They're draft cards from Sauron. I don't know. I have a clue. They're burning.
Rick.
Oh, go ahead.
Rick, Cot, and Tree.
Yeah, whatever that is. That's some weird.
I think maybe like the second one means cottage. I don't know.
Well, I feel bad for Rick getting burned like that, but the other two, I don't know.
All right, and the last one is...
All right, it is currently 9-8.
What is the name of the director of the Weta Workshop LTD?
I think it's Richard Taylor.
You are correct.
9-9. Woo! See, I thought that I was going to win this time, but you pulled it out there.
Did you count the Wolf Hunt one against me? Because I missed that.
Yeah, I counted against you.
Okay, all right.
You had four, and then you got five that time for a total of nine. Okay. Right. And I had five, and I got four for a total of nine. So we tied.
All right.
I thought I was going to win, but I'll take a tie. It's better than losing. So good job. We're actually doing pretty darn well, I think.
Yeah, we're doing. I honestly thought we'd be doing a lot worse.
Yeah, so. This is cool. This is really good. I'm looking forward to when we get to do it for Return of the King. So, okay. So our last thoughts, our conclusions, kind of wrapping things up tonight. Just a couple of things for me. This is again, it's Lord of the Rings, and the extended version particularly gives you so much good, but just there's enough things in it that it's my least favorite. Because I mean. I like Gollum, but not enough to want to watch all of his antics for, you know, a long time. And you get a lot of him in this movie. I love all the Rohan stuff, but it's just a small segment of this movie. I don't love the Ents, and you get a lot of them in this movie. I'm glad they're pretty much done by the end of this movie, and we don't really get the Ents that much in... You know, you get like 2 seconds of Treebeard in Return of the King, and that's about it. So the things I don't like in the entire Lord of the Rings trilogy, a lot of those things are in this particular segment. So, again, it's still Lord of the Rings. I still love it. I just don't have it in like my top 10 movies. So what's kind of your overall conclusion, thoughts about it?
I mean, I understand that, and maybe it is my least favorite of the three, but... that would make it my third favorite movie ever. So it doesn't mean like it's terrible or anything.
Right.
I mean, I agree on the, like even when I watch them by myself, the extended version, like if I would skip any part in this movie, it would be some of the Gollum stuff. Like it's too much.
Yeah.
I mean, and it's my least favorite part of this movie.
Yeah.
Even, I think it's well done.
Right. Exactly.
And I think it's important for plot stuff later on.
Right.
But like after I've seen it a few times, I'm like, I'm okay with it.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm glad I saw it in the theater a couple of times, the whole thing. And I do watch it all the way through, but I'm impatient during the Gollum stuff. I'm also impatient during the Treebeard stuff, but that's kind of by design. We're supposed to be impatient with the Ents. That's kind of the point, you know?
They don't move quickly.
No, they're very deliberate. What do they have to talk about? The consistency of squirrel droppings. I give Gimli credit. Every now and then he does say something pretty good. So he just says a lot that's not that good either. But all right. Well, let's. I'm going to zip along here and make sure. Oh, one other thing I want to ask you about is one other thing that they do in the movies that we haven't really talked about is they try to space out some of the characters that are not in this part of the books so that they appear in all the movies. So, like, for example, you see Arwen and Elrond in the Two Towers, and you're like, wait, we're seeing Arwen and Elrond in the Two Towers? What? You see maybe a little bit of Galadriel talking with Elrond or something, or maybe that's in Return of the King, but you shouldn't see him anymore at all. So what do you make of that? Are you okay with that, or was that kind of annoying to you?
It was annoying. Like, I don't need Arwen in this movie.
Right.
Like, the love scenes or whatever, while Aragorn's thinking about her while he's dazed or whatever. I can't remember what part that is, I think. I think it's the part where he's like half unconscious.
Yeah. But
I don't need that. Like, I get it. I understand why they did it. Because they're setting up the kind of the love triangle thing you were talking about, but I could live without that.
Yeah. It is neat that – I don't think we talked about this before, but the last thing I'll say, it is neat that a lot of that – was Tolkien's own life. You know, he took his own life. He used his life as the model first for Beren and Luthien, and then that became the model for Aragorn and Arwen. And it was based on him because he was Catholic, from South Africa and came to Britain, and that's part of why he had that interesting relationship with C.S. Lewis and the Inklings, is because he was Catholic and they were all very Anglican and all that. And they had different perspectives on Christianity and religion, but also just the idea of being kind of like the outcast or somebody that doesn't fit in with standard society and falling in love with somebody that's from outside of your circle, which, he took and made it into Beren and Luthien. And then, of course, in the movie, Aragorn is singing the song, the Lay of Beren and Luthien, and Frodo says, "What's that song about?" And he says, "It's about a man who loved an elf woman, and she took, she decided to give up her more immortal life to be with him." And Frodo says, "What happens?" And God, I love Viggo Mortensen does such a great job as this incredibly low key Aragorn. He just kind of raises his eyebrows and says, "She died. She died." It's just kind of like it's the same way he delivers that line when they're in Bree, and they're asking about the Nazgul, and and they say, "What are they?" And he just kind of makes that same expression and says, "They were once men." I just love how he does those little matter of fact line readings, basically, And he says, "She died," and Tolkien. Do you know that Tolkien's and his wife's tombstones say Beren and Luthien?
I did not know that.
Yeah. I mean, if you think I'm pulling it out of my hat that he based them on himself and his wife, their tombstones say those characters' names. That's a fact.
And that's the best story in the Silmarillion, I can tell you that.
Yeah, yeah. And that's what Aragorn and Arwen, so. Okay, well, that's cool. That's a good note to wrap up on. So we're going to get on out of here for another episode. I hope that everybody out there enjoyed it. And if you have comments and stuff that we missed or that you want us to maybe pick up on and talk a little bit about in our third episode when we get back together in a couple of weeks probably to do Return of the King, then by all means, contact John or me on Twitter or on me on Facebook, or you can leave a comment either on the White Rocket page or on the Patreon page, and we will see it, and I will make sure we cover it in our next, I know that we're going to do Return of the King. We haven't really talked about if we're going to do anything beyond that. We might do something on The Hobbit or Silmarillion. I don't know, whatever. We can talk about that later, but we're definitely doing Return of the King. Right? I hope. Or is this enough?
Nope, this is it. Wrap it up.
We'll talk about it. We'll decide what we're doing beyond Return of the King, if anything. All right. Well, thanks a bunch, John. I'll let you go for tonight, and I hope you had fun, man.
It was good.
All right. Well, the Rocket getting out of here for another week, and we'll see you guys down the road.
Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network, your station for all things geek, classic, current, and beyond. Be part of the crew at ESONetwork.com.
This has been a White Rocket Entertainment production.
Hi, I'm Jared Albrick, the yard sale artist, and I'm also the art director over at White Rocket Books. Quick question, what do you get when you take a fast-paced Alistair MacLean novel, put it in a blender with a Star Trek DVD, and some G.I. Joe figures? I'm pretty sure you get award-winning sci-fi novelist Van Allen Plexico's first foray into the world of comics, a new comic miniseries based on Plexico's novella Cold Lightning. Cold Lightning is a small part of Plexico's expansive space opera series of novels called The Shattering. Now, real quick, I want to give a quick heartfelt thank you to all the folks who helped us reach our crowdfunding goal over on GoFundMe. We are so excited to get this comic series underway. Now, depending on when you hear this ad, we're either still working away on this space adventure, or it may be available already. The best way to find out is to head over to whiterocketbooks.com and see what the latest is. While you're there, you can look into all the novels of the Shattering series or Plexico's very popular Sentinels novel series. There's plenty to see, so come check us out. Once again, that's whiterocketbooks.com.